This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie. This podcast was recorded at the second Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in March of 2007. The speaker is Emmett O'Connor, a senior lecturer in history at McGee College. The topic is Syndicalism in Ireland, 1917 to 1923. You can find anarchist articles on Irish history at www.wsm.ie/history.
Okay, I think we'll get going. We have 45 minutes, so Emmett O'Connor here, who's a lecturer in McGee College, is going to give us a talk on Syndicalism in Ireland. He's published two books, I think, Syndicalism in Ireland, his one, and the other one's called Red in the Green, Ireland, what's it on, the Communist International?
Yeah, Ireland, Russia, the Communist International.
Ireland, Russia, the Communist International. So, if you want to lead off, then people can ask questions.
Thanks for the invitation to speak. I'm pleased to know that some people are still interested in syndicalism. There are many forms of socialist struggle, and some are marginal in terms of their popularity, and are still marginal. Others were mainstream and are now gone but not forgotten. And syndicalism is a rare case of a mainstream form of struggle becoming almost forgotten. And this is all the more curious in the Irish context, because it's not often that socialism becomes really very mainstream and very influential in Ireland. And it's remarkable that syndicalism had such a direct impact on labour between 1917 and 1923. So this was due chiefly to two sets of factors. One was Connolly and Larkin, and the other then was structural and political conditions. But before looking at these, I'll just talk briefly about syndicalism and why it was. It emerged in the late 1880s in response to what was seen as the failure of existing socialist strategies. Marx had expected a revolution in 1848, and then later on he thought it would certainly come within his own day. But by the 1880s, it was clear, you know, that socialism seemed to be as far away as ever. And this is all the more troubling to socialists because workers were now getting the vote. By the 1880s, some workers at least had the vote. And it was obvious that some of them at least were not voting for the left. So why was this? The syndicalists argued that socialist parties were failing to connect with the working classes because they were coming dominated by hidebound doctrine and by middle-class intellectuals. So what was needed was to appeal to workers at the point of production, you know, where they worked in the factories or in the fields. That's where they were most class-conscious, and that's where they were most powerful, because they didn't have the vote, but they had this economic power. So that was, at that point, was the best to mobilise them. And to reach workers, you then had to appeal to workers through working-class organisations, and the biggest and most effective of these were the trade unions. So syndicalism became synonymous with trade unionism, and it takes its name from syndicat, the French syndicat, which is the French word for trade union. The syndicalists then argued that political struggle should be waged through industrial struggle, through strikes, sabotage, ghost laws, factory occupations, etc. How then would the revolution come about? Well, there were two chief scenarios for this. In France, the main syndicalist organisation was the CGT, or the Confédération Générale du Travail, the General Confederation of Labour. And they believed in the general strike. The argument was that every strike should be seen as a kind of skirmish in the struggle, all culminating ultimately in the general strike. And in the general strike, workers would seize control of the means of production. And if you had control of the means of production, everything else followed. You control society, you control politics. And that would be the kind of prism of the revolution. You had an alternative strategy then developing in the United States through the Socialist Labour Party initially, led by Daniel DeLeon, and then the Industrial Workers of the World, the IWW, or the Wobblies, as they were called. Now, they argued for industrial unionism, and in America, syndicalism was usually called revolutionary industrial unionism. So their argument was that instead of workers being organised on a trade basis, you know, having all the plumbers in one union, having all the engineers in one union, all the carpenters in a union, you organise unions on an industrial basis. Get everybody in the transport industry in one union. You know, clerks, you know, bus drivers, carpenters, plumbers, all who work in this industry. Get everybody in the textile industry in one union, and so on. And in this way, you could prepare to control these industries within the unions, and then at a certain point you could actually take over the industries. And ideally in the process the workers should be federated in one big union, the OBU. So that the Wobbly saw themselves as an OBU that would consolidate onto the point where they organised most of the workers, and then they would take over control of the economy. So the idea was that the real battle, the real class struggle is fought on the shop floor, and politics, as James Connolly put it, is only the echo of the battle. Now between 1890 and 1914, there was a steady increase in the number of strikes with violence throughout the industrial world. When we talk about the industrial world, we're talking about Western Europe, bits of Eastern Europe, the United States, Eastern Canada, bits of Australia, bits of Venezuela, Colombia. And throughout these areas, there was a steady growth of industrial militancy, and also an increase of strikes with violence and a state intervention. Increasingly, police and the army were being used against strikers. And this seemed to kind of confirm the syndicalist view that, you know, industrial struggle was political struggle, and it was all leading ultimately to political confrontation with the state. Now, to turn to Connolly and Larkin, by the early 1900s, syndicalism was a natural home for anyone who wanted to be at the cutting edge of socialist revolutionism. So, I mean, if you saw yourself as a revolutionary socialist at that time, chances were you're going to be a syndicalist. And that continued until about 1917, when Bolshevism then displaced syndicalism as the leading form of revolutionism. So it's not surprising that Connolly and Larkin were both syndicalists. Connolly had admired the Socialist Labour Party and the Wobblies in the United States, and he set out his American syndicalist ideas in the pamphlet Socialism Made Easy, which was published in 1908. And Larkin attended the founding conference of the Industrial Syndicalist Education League in England in 1910. Before he left for America in 1914, in the wake of the lockout, Larkin never really recovered from the lockout, and he went off to America in October of 1914. Before that point, he was very much the more influential of the two. You know, we tend to kind of think of Connolly and Larkin sort of co-equal leaders, but it was Larkin who was really the main man. He had come to Ireland in 1907 as an agent of the National Union of Dock Labourers, and he made his name leading the Belfast strike in that summer, almost 100 years ago. Employers then coined the term Larkinism to distinguish this new kind of militancy from what they called bona fide trade unionism. And for employers, the sympathetic strike was at the core of Larkinism. Larkin certainly emphasised the need for sympathetic action as a weapon in struggle, and he believed that it was really essential in the context of Ireland. At this time, there would have been about 900,000 wage workers in Ireland, and only about 70,000 of these were unionised. About 700,000 workers, so about 7 out of every 9 workers, were in agriculture, textiles and clothing, domestic service or general unskilled occupations. In other words, they were in occupations that were low paid, they had low productivity, they didn't have a skill, so they were very easily replaced. And employers believed that, employers at that time generally accepted trade unionism for craftsmen. They believed that, you know, partly because they believed that, you know, to be a craftsman was to be, you know, to be a respectable person. And these people were entitled to trade unionism. But the unskilled worker, you really couldn't trust something as dangerous as trade unionism in the hands of the unskilled worker. And in any case, the economy couldn't afford it, because the success of the economy depended on low wages. And that meant that keeping these workers out of trade unions. So the general employer attitude throughout Ireland, not just in Dublin or even in Belfast, but throughout Ireland, was that craft unionism is okay, but unskilled unionism should not be accepted. So it was to overcome this employer militancy that Larkin believed that sympathetic action was essential. But Larkin also introduced other features of syndicalism. He was very interested in the idea of making the trade union a social centre for members and their families, which is a very syndicalist idea. The syndicalists believed in what's sometimes called workerism, you know, this celebration of the worker as you know, having a kind of an innate decency, a proper sense of culture. You know, the worker knows what to do, that the, you know, these intellectuals just kind of complicate things. And socialist society should also be about promoting working class values like solidarity, sharing, cooperation. And you should build up these within the trade union. You should make the trade union a kind of microcosm of this social world. And at least from 1911, at least, Larkin was very interested in this. And I think in many ways he's more interested in that side of things than interested in strikes and militancy. And he certainly did a lot to try and promote the ITGW as a cultural centre and as a kind of showcase of these working class values. Now, to move on to look at syndicalism then between 1917 and 1923. Larkin left for America in October of 1914, and he didn't return until 1923. There's a lot of controversy about why he didn't return, and we didn't get into that here, but he got involved in various things in America. He was imprisoned in 1920. It wasn't until after his release in 1923 that he came back to Ireland. And then Connolly was executed in 1916. So it was in the absence of these two leaders that, that syndicalism kind of reached its most influential period. So why did this happen? Well, first of all, there was the World War. And for workers on the home front, it was a war of two halves. From 1914 to 1916, wages were largely frozen. I mean, there hadn't been a big war previously, you know, since the Napoleonic Wars. There weren't the kind of mechanisms to deal with inflation. And initially, of course, it was thought that it would be a short war. So there wasn't the machinery in place to deal with the economic consequences of war. Wages were frozen, food became scarcer and scarcer, prices went up, and social tensions increased because workers felt that certain sectors, farmers, shopkeepers, employers, they were doing well out of the war. They were getting higher prices for their food or for their military-related produce. But this was all at the expense of the workers. Now, these problems existed in Britain on a much bigger scale, and it was the threat of strikes by workers in the munitions industry in 1916 that forced the British government to change its kind of domestic its economic policy on the domestic front. And to keep the war economy going, the government started to liquidate national assets and release more money into the economy. So it began to approve wage increases. So in Britain, the threat of a strike in the munitions industry was a real kind of turning point. The equivalent in Ireland, I think, was the railway strike, or the threat of the railway strike in the autumn of 1916. The railway men were threatening a national rail strike. The union itself was against this, so it was very much a rank and file movement, and it was proposing to take this very serious action independently. And to avert the strike then, the government agreed to pay the railway men a war bonus. The railway company said it couldn't afford a war bonus. During the war you couldn't get a wage increase, but in certain circumstances you could get a war bonus for the duration of the war. So because there were 32 railway companies at the time, and because they said they couldn't afford to pay this increase, the government took over the railways for the period of the war, and it agreed to pay the railway this war bonus. So it was a huge victory, you know, not just for workers, but for a rank and file movement against the leadership of a movement which had been saying, look, you know, we shouldn't push this too far. It was a victory against the railway companies, it was a victory against the government, and it set an important example to other workers. A second important state intervention in 1917 was the introduction of compulsory tillage, because by late 1916 there was talk about famine, you know, with the growing food shortage and so on. So the government obliged farmers to bring at least 10% of their arable land under tillage in 1917, and at least 15% in 1918. So tillage is labour intensive, and it gave agricultural workers an immediate scarcity value. So they now started to try and exploit this and to organise in local unions to demand wage increases. So between 1917 and 1918, there was a profits boom. You know, 1914 to 1916, seeing a profits boom, but things were getting worse for workers, for wage workers. But from 1917 to 1918, wages started to rise, and in some cases they were rising faster than prices and profits. The war then was followed by a short consumer boom because of the release of pent-up consumer demand. There were all sorts of things people couldn't buy during the war. When the war ended, they now had the opportunity to do that. So in 1919, things got even better. And that continued until well into 1920. So in these circumstances, there was a huge expansion of trade unionism. Membership of the Irish Trade Union Congress was probably about 70,000 in 1916. And it rose to 230,000 by 1920. The main beneficiary of this was the ITGWU. Probably in 1913, just before the lockout, it probably had maybe about 18,000 members, something like that. By 1916, it had declined to about 5,000. But by 1920, it had expanded to 120,000. And Labour became a national force for the first time. There were 15 trade councils in Ireland in 1918, for example, and 46 by 1921. So we're not just talking about the big cities, we're talking about, you know, the countryside as well, the north and south, and indeed the 32 counties. Now, as well as that, this was a time of revolution at home and abroad. In Russia, the Bolsheviks had seized power and declared a workers' state in October 1917. There was a Soviet in Hungary which lasted for about 2 weeks. There were factory takeovers in Soviets in Germany and in Italy. And then at home there was a national revolution. It had a limited social dimension, but nonetheless it was a revolution and it demonstrated the political nature of the state. You know, the very fact that Sinn Féin took over the state or created their own state, it showed that the state was not above politics. It was something that people could grasp and shape, and, you know, according to their own political values. And as well as that, the National Revolution paralysed the police. Certainly by, you know, late 1919, the police were pretty helpless. And that made life a lot easier for strikers and people taking direct action. Meant that they could more or less do this without police intervention. On top of that, it was widely believed that the world was on the verge of a new age of the people. The war seemed to have discredited the ruling class. People thought that it was going to be followed by a new age of democracy. And there was a new interest in labour. The Irish Messenger, for example, which is a Catholic publication, which published a series of pamphlets outlining the Catholic Church perspective on various things. They published five pamphlets on the church and the labour question in 1913, the year of the lockout. In 1918, they published 28. So, you know, the church clearly believed that things were changing. Everyone believed labour was going to become a lot more important in the future than ever before. There was even, this is absolutely incredible, but there was even a book on labour written by an Irish academic. And this was George O'Brien, who wrote the book Labour Organisation, published in 1921. Another book on labour by an Irish academic did not appear until 1973. So it gives you an idea of how different things were at this time. Now, in what ways was Labour syndicalist? There weren't car-carrying syndicalists in Ireland at that time. There wasn't a group, you know, called the Irish Syndicalist Movement or whatever. The term was used, though it wasn't used very widely. Industrial unionism was probably used more widely. But Labour can be characterised as syndicalist in a number of ways. First of all, tactics. There was a spontaneous revival of the pre-war Larkin tactics of sympathetic action. And in some cases, these were extended to local general strikes. Between 1917 and 1920, there were 18 of these local general strikes, mainly in towns like Youghal, Dungarvan or Charleville, where all workers joined the transport union and they put forward wage demands on a common basis. During these strikes, the town would be taken over by a strike committee. And they would introduce a permit system. The permit system was a way of ensuring that you control transport movements, but it was also a way of ensuring that everybody, including the employers, accepted the responsibility of the strike committee. They accepted the authority of the strike committee. So even employers would be given permits to move their goods here and there, signed by the union secretary and so on. And that meant, you know, the employers were in effect accepting that they worked under union government. Then our workplace seizures of Soviets, almost all involving the ITGW, these emerged from November of 1918 onwards, substantially as strike tactics, but indicating too political ambition. The most extensive seizure was that of 13 Limerick creameries in 1920, and this was a very well-planned affair. It was directed by three socialist transport union officials. On the 16th of May 1920, they hoisted a red flag over the central creamery at Knock Long in County Limerick, and they hung out a banner which read, "We make butter, not profits. Knock Long Creamery Soviet." The Watchword of Labour, which is the transport union paper at the time, later compared the creamery Soviets with the takeover of the Fiat car works in Turin, though it did concede that Turin represented what it called an advance on Knock Long. These strikes, especially in rural areas, were also likely to be accompanied by sabotage or violence. Then, as well as tactics, he had strategy. Now, this is clearly evident in trade union strategy. By 1918, the ITGW was facing an entirely novel problem. It didn't have to go out and organise workers anymore. Its problem was how to make sense of the fact that thousands of workers were flooding into the unions. How did you organise these most effectively to maximise your power and influence? And in response, it turned to Connolly's pamphlet Socialism Made Easy for an answer. So on the 1st of July 1918, Liberty Hall issued the Lines of Progress pamphlet, which is intended, quote, to advance Connolly's OBU idea in order to develop a scientific solution to the labour question. And it said, "With this machine, the OBU, in their possession, the workers of Ireland can break all their chains with ease, and from the mere rallying cry of political parties," that's a very syndicalist turn of phrase, it's kind of, you know, dismissing political parties and saying, look, the really important engines of change are industrial, the unions. From the mere rallying cry of political parties, it can turn freedom into a glorious reality. No power on earth can prevent the realisation of this programme of a million Irish workers organised under the banner of the Irish Workers' Union, but the treachery of the Irish workers themselves. Some people have detected a certain amount of wriggle room in that final statement about the treachery of the workers, that this was kind of an escape clause maybe for union leaders. I'm not so sure about that. I think it just reflected the incredible confidence of Labour that was there in 1918, 1919, much of 1920, that we're into a totally new age and Labour's going to be a power in the land from now on. Trade union growth had a major impact on Congress. The 1918 annual Congress took as its objective the promotion of the working class organisation socially, politically, and socially, industrially, and politically in cooperatives, trade unions, and a political party. And in November of 1918, it changed its name from the Irish Trade Union Congress to the from the Irish Trade Union Congress and Labour Party to the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress. So it's putting the political objective first. And in that conference, it adopted a socialist programme demanding collective ownership of wealth and democratic management of production. Then in 1919, Congress voted to transform itself into a single Irish Workers' Union, which would be organised in 10 industrial sectors. And the intention here was to, and I quote, to create a single all-inclusive Irish Workers' Union, which through its industrial and political activities would eventually realise the taking over control of industry by the organised working class. That was their official objective. As well as that, Congress called four general strikes during this period. 1918 was a general strike against conscription. On the 1st of May 1919 was a general strike for the for May Day to become a national holiday, or indeed an international holiday, and also for self-determination. In 1920 there was a political prisoner strike, which was really quite remarkable because the Irish Labour Party and Trade Union Congress executive called an indefinite general strike for the following day. And as the Manchester Guardian reported, in many places, the direction of affairs during the strike passed to workers' councils, which were formed not on a local but on a class basis. It is no exaggeration to trace a flavour of proletarian dictatorship about some aspects of the strike. And the strike was incredibly successful because it panicked Dublin Castle into thinking that the National Revolution was turning Bolshevik, and Dublin Castle released the prisoners on hunger strike immediately. And then the fourth general strike was in 1922. This was against militarism in a kind of attempt to prevent the moves towards civil war. So as well as tactics and strategy, then there were values. Syndicalism was evident in the development or attempts to develop a working class counterculture through cooperatives, through May Day parades, Éireachtaí, or these open air festivals that were held at the time, and the production of Labour newspapers. And Liberty Hall revived pre-war ideas on alternative morality, which of course Larkin had developed initially. The annual report for the Union for 1919 directed members to conceive of the Union as a social centre around which they can build every activity of their existence and which, wisely used, can be made to remedy all their grievances. As well as that, in 1919 the trade unions founded the James Connolly Labour College, which enrolled over 200 students in classes in history, economics and public administration. An appeal for lecturers in the Watchword of Labour advised that the working class outlook was an essential requirement of their curriculum vitae, because unless you become as proletarians, you cannot enter the workers' republic. The college flourished up to November of 1920, when it was raided and ransacked by the auxiliaries, and it was never revived. Now, what happened to all of this? Well, the short answer is the slump. The World War had led to a huge expansion of the world's productive capacity and to a crisis of overproduction. So, in the autumn of 1920, agricultural prices started to fall, and by 1921, most sectors of the economy were affected. And by December of that year, it's reckoned that about 26% of insured workers were unemployed. There was no dole at that time, but the British government introduced unemployment insurance in 1911. It was generally called the ninepence for fourpence, because you paid in fourpence a week, and if you're unemployed, you got back ninepence for every fourpence you paid in. So you got limited benefit, while you still have insurance. When your insurance ran out, then there was no benefit at all. So you had an unemployment rate of at least 26%, which of course is very high. In these circumstances, employers demanded wage cuts. They said, "Look, wages just got completely out of control because of the war and inflation and so on. We've now got to get wages back to normal," as they put it, back to pre-1914 levels. And at the Irish Trade Union Congress in 1921, unions pledged that they would hold the harvest. That was the term they used, hold the harvest of wage gains. They said, look, we're not going to accept any reductions, no return to 1914. If any one sector is attacked, we'll all stand together. But when it came to the crunch, they didn't do that. They tried to negotiate or to fight on a sectional basis. And when things started to go wrong, the unions all started to blame each other. So a lot of infighting broke out. The whole kind of spirit of 1917-21, it all went sour very, very quickly. And you had an industrial war. The employers reckoned that the same thing would happen in Ireland as happened in Britain following Black Friday. The British had this big alliance called the Triple Alliance of railwaymen, miners and transport workers. And they pledged they would stand together against wage cuts, but they decided that they wouldn't back the miners in April of 1921. This became known in British labour history as Black Friday. When the Triple Alliance collapsed, there was a huge reduction in wage levels in all other sectors. And employers thought the same thing would happen in Ireland. But it didn't, because I think mainly because of the very unsettled political conditions. That you had this period between the truce and the treaty, and then you had the time of the provisional government and the civil war. So it was really 1923 by the time stability was being restored by the Free State Army. And you had this 2-year wage war which went on in sort of fits and starts, until the final phase was the Autumn Crisis, as it was called, of 1923. And I reckon that there were about 20,000 workers who took strike action or were locked out in the autumn of 1923. But by December of that year, it was all over, and Labour was badly beaten. Unlike 1913, there was no moral victory for Labour. The leadership of the movement had been inexperienced, you know, in pledging that they would hold a harvest. And promising so much and delivering so little generated widespread disillusionment among the rank and file. There were about 80 Soviets declared in 1922, for example, but the transport union leadership gave them no support and allowed them to be crushed by the army. And then the political climate after 1923, both politically and economically, was very unsympathetic for Labour. And trade unions, they had no wish to sustain the memory of the militancy or the radicalism of 1917 to 1923. So they were happy to forget about the past. The industrial defeat also changed the Labour Party. In the 1922 general election, Labour had won 21% of the vote. Now, the circumstances of the election were a bit unusual because of the Collins de Valera Pact. Not all constituencies were contested. So you could argue that some people voted Labour because Labour was the only alternative to what might have been seen as a Sinn Féin dictatorship. On the other hand, Labour put up 18 candidates. 17 were elected. Some of them with huge, you know, surplus votes. And it's clear that if Labour had put up more candidates, they would have got more people elected. It completely underestimated their strength in June of 1922. The next general election was in August of 1923, and now the party erred on the opposite side. They thought they would do even better in 23, but instead their vote dropped to 11%. And I think the main reason for that is because the Labour Party had shown itself to be completely irrelevant to the industrial struggle. The first cohort of Labour TDs were mainly trade union officials who were elected on the basis of their record, you know, as leaders in direct action. But then as TDs, they seemed to be just useless, you know, to the industrial war. I think that was a major reason for the big decline in the Labour vote. And as trade unionism disintegrated beneath them, the Labour TDs then began to rebuild their electoral bases along clientelist lines. And that's been the story of Irish politics indeed ever since. So finally, why did syndicalism have such a big impact on Ireland? Well, first of all, the conditions, economic and political, were right. The class tensions because of the war, the profits boom again because of the war, a labour shortage, and the revolution at home and abroad. So these were exceptionally favourable times for labour. Secondly, then, because of Connolly and Larkin, it's because of their influence, because of what Connolly had written, because of Larkin's, you know, the example that Larkin provided in trade union leadership. Syndicalism was the kind of radicalism, it was the kind of militancy that Irish Labour knew. I mean, they didn't really know much about Bolshevism, or they didn't have much tradition of parliamentary socialism or social democracy. Syndicalism was all they knew, so that was what they turned to when conditions seemed to be favourable in 1917 and afterwards. And finally, a comparative point. In many countries, the established trade unions were hostile to the syndicalists, and the syndicalists formed their own unions on the margins of the existing organised labour movement in sectors that were regarded by the established unions as being too hard to organise. So very often this meant geographical marginalisation too. If you take the Wobblies, for example, they were most successful in the western states of America among miners, migrant labourers, timber workers. The Italian syndicalist union, the UZI as it was called, about half of their members were farm labourers in the Emilia-Romagna area, a very underdeveloped backward area. And again, in Canada, in the later war years, now just after the war, a syndicalist movement developed called the One Big Union Movement. And that was based mainly on workers in Western Canada. The workers in Eastern Canada, you know, remained in the existing trade unions. So if you think of Ireland as a fringe area of trade unions, because before Larkin came along, Ireland was in effect a part of the British Labour Movement. So if you think of it as a sort of fringe area of the British Labour Movement, formally a part of it, but in practice neglected by it, if you think of it as an economically marginal region with a heavy reliance on primary production, and as an area where effective strike tactics had to be militant, then it actually becomes a fairly typical centre of syndicalism. So it's not hard to explain Irish syndicalism. It's more difficult to explain why it's been completely forgotten. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Questions, comments, biggest disagreements? Sean?
I was just going to ask, what was the role of the provisional government, especially the Republican movement, in terms of undermining the class struggle? And was, I know it was quite a period of intense class struggle during this period, but was the Labour struggle autonomous from the National Project, or were they interlinked? Because a lot of Republicans tend to have a dramatic view that they were complementary, or were some areas autonomous from the National Struggle itself?
Well, first of all, the main concern of the provisional government was the establishment of the authority of the government, and they had a kind of rolling agenda in that respect. So most of the country was under IRA control, so they were prepared to compromise economically and on social objectives whilst they could get themselves established politically to begin with. So in other words, when workers took over the Cleese's factory, for example, they wanted Cleese to compromise, and they're willing in fact to negotiate workers buying out the Cleese combine. But by September of 1922, they haven't completed the military victory over the IRA, but they're well on the way to doing that, and they're willing now to take a tougher line against wage conflict. So they sanctioned the first strike in which the government's directly involved, and that's against the postal workers. So that clearly indicates a much harder line that the government's willing to take by that stage. So you can see the government gradually becoming more sort of anti-labour as its power, you know, consolidates. As late as August of 1923, they were still frightened of Labour linking up with Republicanism. And Larkin had threatened to do that, so they persuaded employers to postpone wage cuts in August of 1923 until the general election was over. But once the election was over, they're in a pretty safe position, so they're quite happy to take on wage strikes at that point. And after 1923, the Cumann-na-Gael government really has no time at all for Labour. You know, they wind up the old Labour department that had existed under the British government and indeed under the Republican government, and Labour just doesn't feature in public policy after 23. With regard to the connection between Labour struggle and the Republican movement, yeah, wage struggle was autonomous to the extent that it wasn't sort of a byproduct of political factors. It was due to the economic and social conditions which were created mainly by the war. And to that extent, it's autonomous. But Labour is clearly benefiting from the kind of political conditions that have been created by Sinn Féin. So the kind of political climate is advantageous to Labour. But the real kind of trade-off between the Labour movement and Sinn Féin at this time, I think, is the benevolent neutrality of the IRA towards the wages movement. I think that's the main one. The IRA doesn't interfere with the wages movement. And that's the big sort of payoff as far as Labour is concerned.
The Spanish Revolution as well, neutrality, ambiguous.
Yeah.
You say the IRA didn't interfere with the wages movement. Do you mean the IRA didn't interfere with any of the Soviets that were set up in Limerick and Cork?
Yeah, I think...
Was it not Frank Ryan that took down the red flag in Knock On?
You might be right, I didn't know that. But, I mean, if you... You might be able to point out to one or two instances, but... If you look at the unrest by the congests, as they were called, by small farmers in the west of Ireland in 1920, Sinn Féin mounts a big operation against them with a mixture of carrot and stick. They send in the IRA, they send in Dáil Cóirts, and with a mixture of carrot and stick, they defuse that problem. It is no equivalent intervention against wage unrest, although wage unrest is a much bigger factor in society it's potentially a much more divisive factor. But there's no equivalent IRA intervention against the wages movement.
I was wondering that a bit. You spoke of the use of the pamphlet Socialism by Easy, but Terence Condy with Transport Union is about propagandism and that. But I was wondering about, you know, the compilation of James Condy's novels, Ash to the Roof, which was printed by the IDW. I don't know if it was hundreds or possibly thousands of the pamphlets in 1921, but they were never distributed. And I was wondering, like, the only came into currency probably in the 70s, and they're quite prevalent now because they're just in the store somewhere for decades and decades. I was wondering, like, after Socialism made it easy, and after, say, 1921 or possibly 23, you know, was like pamphleteering, did it dry up or stop for any reason? Because actually, the route itself would have been a very powerful and simple syndicalist document, which would have explained syndicalism to any very literate person in a simple way.
Yeah.
Was it consciously suppressed? Like, if the order did.
It did kind of dry up, you know. They issued The Lines of Progress in 1918, and there were some of Connolly's works produced by the Socialist Party of Ireland, which was kind of controlled by the ITGW as well. In 1934, I think they brought out an issue of the Axe to the Root. But yeah, I mean, you people like William O'Brien, you know, and for all his faults, and indeed he had them, but he was nonetheless of that kind of, you know, generation which believed in that kind of political pamphleteering as being an important part of the movement. But I think the people who came after him were a later generation, and they just didn't believe in that, you know. To some extent, maybe it was revived in the 1960s, and you had a few pamphlets coming out at that point. You know.
Yeah, I think where the cut-off point comes there is probably in the 40s, the collection that the ITG kind of sponsored in the 40s of Connolly's writings, that William O'Brien was kind of, the syndicalist stuff is hardly ever there. I think in the 30s there was still being published then. But just a couple of points I wanted to make. The thing you were saying about Larkin was very interested in the union being a social centre and a cultural centre as well as being a syndicalist idea. Is it not likely that he could have got that from his experience in the English Socialist movement as well, the way the Independent Labour Party and the Clarion movement were all into having cycling clubs and dramatic societies and book clubs as well? I mean that could have, you know, come together with the syndicalist thing. I think you said in 1917 Bolshevism started to displace syndicalism. I think it's not necessarily a question of displacing it. The two kind of went together. People, I mean, a lot of syndicalists around the world, in France and in America and all, they saw the Russian Revolution as their revolution as well, and ended up supporting the Communist International. I think it was, and even the way the workplace closures called themselves Soviets in imitation of what happened in Russia, I think people saw it as kind of workers' control, and whether it was from a syndicalist direction or a Marxist direction didn't really matter so much. And just a question, all of those Soviets, well, not all of them, but the vast majority of them, and the big expansion of the labour movement tends to happen outside of Dublin. In Dublin, not so much. Why do you think that was? Was it, had the Dublin working class not fully recovered from 1913, or was it that the state was stronger in Dublin than in the rest of the country? I'm just curious why you think that.
Yeah, well, just to do the last point first, it was because the union officials were stronger in Dublin than the rest of the country. That's where they were located. Right? It was easier for rank and file movements to operate where the union officials were much weaker. And you find, I mean, one of the problems for the ITGW, problems from a leadership perspective, is that the union grows too quickly. So many branches created. And it's really about 1920 when William O'Brien is trying to, you know, establish his control, he's trying to centralise the union. And he has a big branch movement, I think it was called, to try and reduce the number of branches and create more full-time officials. So I think that's one of the reasons why you have so much kind of this direct action taking place outside of Dublin. And of course the agricultural workers are very important in that too, and they have their tradition of militancy. And you see, in many cases, they had to form their own local unions first, and then these unions became absorbed into the ITGW. So that made him kind of a bit more independent of the union, you know. With regard to the other points, Bolshevism, yeah, I mean, certainly some people felt that, people like, you know, Cathal Shannon in Ireland, I mean, they felt there was no contradiction between a Bolshevik and being a syndicalist. And of course, a lot of the syndicalists did, indeed Larkin to some extent felt the same. But it gradually became clear that, you know, if you were a communist, if you were a Bolshevik, as far as the Bolsheviks saw it anyway, that meant that you followed the Comintern and you subscribed to that kind of discipline. And the Bolsheviks had this one unanswerable argument in disputes or debates with other socialist tendencies, and that was they had done it. They had actually created the first workers' state, as people thought it was. And that seemed to them to be, to a lot of people, to be, you know, unanswerable. That showed that Bolshevism was, you know, the formula that worked, that was the way forward. But you had some people then become disillusioned, notably Emma Goldman and so on, with the Bolshevik Revolution and the way it was turning out. And that disillusionment is evident as early as 1922, maybe, certainly by 1924. With regard to the cultural aspect of syndicalism, yeah, you could trace all of the, you know, various strands within syndicalism, like industrial unionism. I mean, to some extent, you could trace that back to the Chartists, to the Grand National Consolidated Trade Union of the 1830s. Where's our speaker, William Thompson? You could probably tell us more about that. And that whole idea of the one big union was there as early as the 1830s. The idea of a counterculture is certainly there with the Clarion bands. Larkin had been a member of the ILP. In fact, in about 1943, he was made an honorary member of the ILP by Jimmy Maxton. And he made a speech and he said, you know, that the ILP was always closer to his idea of a political party than any other. I mean, for Larkin, socialism was always a sort of a humanist religion, really, rather than, a kind of scientific, you know, doctrinaire creed. So, yeah, I mean, the syndicalists were never very strong in Britain, but they did certainly build on that idea of counterculture that had been there earlier on. And that had a very strong appeal, I think, to Larkin, who was always interested in the idea of culture anyway. And always believed that, you know, workers, that socialists should bring culture to the masses and bring working class culture into the mainstream and make working class values the centre of culture rather than having bourgeois values the centre of culture. And then finally, just on the propaganda war aspect, yeah, I mean, William O'Brien always believed in this, and in, of course, 1923, his war with Larkin, he brought out the pamphlet, The Attempt to Smash the ITGWU. So you did have a kind of propaganda war between them. And O'Brien always identified himself very closely with James Connolly. And he was instrumental in getting Connolly's works published in the 1940s. And then conversely, O'Brien wanted to, you know, eliminate Larkin. In fact, in 1959, the ITGW brought out a souvenir pamphlet, souvenir brochure of the Union to commemorate its Golden Jubilee. And William O'Brien wrote the chapter on the 1913 lockout, and he wrote a 2,000 word history of the lockout and never once mentioned Jim Larkin's name.
I've got two people questions, so maybe we'll take them both, Mary.
A very short one. Going back to the benevolent neutrality that you mentioned between the Labour movement and the Republicans, I wondered whether there was maybe a quid pro quo for Labour staying out of the 1918 election, and that explained kind of at the handle for the next few years. But then as it became clear that in 1921 that Labour could be a major force, I'm sort of speaking very generally of the Labour Party and syndicalists, you know, Labour in that sense, both electorally and less structurally. But whether by 1922 then, with the creation of the provisional government and the state being established in subsequent years, that it was more, well, okay, we've paid our debt, such as it was for 1918, and that there might actually have been a formal agreement to be handed off for a few years, but that the much more conservative project that would always be a part of Sinn Féin and the politics at that time was starting to come to the fore.
Yeah, well, in relation to 1918, De Valera's remark, Labour must wait, you know, is often quoted, but De Valera never said that. In fact, nobody in Sinn Féin said anything like that. Their message was the exact opposite. Now, they saw Labour, both sides, both the Redmondites and Sinn Féin, felt, you know, labour is getting important and it's going to be a force in the future. We have to square these people, you know, one way or another. We have to get them on board, and it's better that this should be on our side rather than the other side. So the Sinn Féin message in 1918 was that Labour should join with Sinn Féin in the revolution. Now, Labour didn't want to do that because they thought, if we do, we don't know where these people are going to go. They could take us down the same road they went down in 1916. Liberty Hall is shelled, leaders are arrested, there's all sorts of trouble for Labour. So Labour was just too nervous about getting involved with the National Revolution. But it, even after the 1918 elections, Sinn Féin still reckons that Labour has the potential to create a lot of difficulty for the National Revolution. So in that sense, there is an understanding about a quid pro quo that the IRA doesn't interfere with the wages movement, and in return, Labour doesn't create problems for Sinn Féin. I think that understanding is there. And there are one or two cases where you do get instances of IRA involvement with the wages movement, and people like William O'Brien writing to Sinn Féin saying, what's going on here? You're not supposed to interfere with our movement. Leave us alone. And Sinn Féin then, or the IRA, sort of back off. Now, when the provisional government is formed, as I said earlier, their immediate problem is political stability, so they kind of go soft on Labour. But as their political power consolidates, they're able more and more to assert their own kind of class interests against Labour. So certainly by 1923, the provisional government, the Free State government as it is, it feels free to adopt a straightforward kind of class line against Labour. And of course, Tom Garvin likes to argue that there was no right left dimension to the Civil War split, and that the treaty divided the left from the left and the right from the right. And in one sense, that's true, in that there were left wing people who were pro treaty, there were right wing people who were anti treaty. But by and large, the Conservatives were pro treaty, and the Radicals were anti treaty. That's generalisation, but that was a fact. So the Conservative government, the Conwy government of 1922-23, was generally a very conservative anti-Labour government.
You were saying earlier in the lecture that the Bolsheviks and the syndicalists were interchangeable, the terms, when the revolution happened, because the syndicalists saw it as their revolution. Before Lenin actually left Germany and went after the revolution, I think it was the revolution actually a syndicalist one and he turned it into a modern Bolshevik one? Or was it actually a Bolshevik one from the beginning?
The Russian Revolution?
Yeah, the Russian one. Because you know, the Soviets had discernment of autonomy before democratic centralism.
I don't think syndicalism was ever particularly strong in Russia, so just in terms of who was behind the revolution, it was the Bolsheviks, it was the people who called themselves the Social Democratic Labour Party, the Russian Social Democratic Labour Party.
The Mensheviks as well.
But I mean, in the West, both the syndicalists and the left generally identified with Russia. The Labour Party in Ireland identified with the Russian Revolution and supported it. And everybody claimed, that what was going on in Russia kind of vindicated their version of socialism. But in terms of who controlled the direction of politics in Russia, it was the Bolsheviks.
Never the syndicalists?
No, I don't think so.
Thank you.
I think that's 5 o'clock, so.
This podcast was recorded at the second Dublin Anarchist Book Fair in March of 2007. The speaker is Emmett O'Connor, a senior lecturer in history at McGee College. The topic is Syndicalism in Ireland, 1917 to 1923. You can find anarchist articles on Irish history at www.wsm.ie/history. This is a podcast from the Workers' Solidarity Movement. You'll find our webpage at www.wsm.ie.